Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Jared Ball has an analysis of the state of hip-hop politics and is the U.S. empire setting itself up for a fall?
But first, the Obama administration is running the political line that jobs are finally coming back. The problem is they're the wrong kind of jobs. Labor economist Mark Brenner explains.
If you look at the last jobs report, it was really obvious that we are a long way away from where we need to be. I mean, people in Washington were trumpeting the better than, you know, expected jobs numbers last month, you know, 230,000 new private sector jobs. But when you dig in below the numbers, about half of those jobs are kind of what you might call dead-end jobs. I mean, they're temp services, retail, trade, and food service. And, I mean, look, if you think that you're going to build a recovery around more Home Depot cashiers and Walmart greeters, you know, you need to have your head looked at. These are not jobs that you can pay a mortgage on, send your kids to college on. This is not a job that's really going to get spending going again, that's really going to get growth going again. So, you know, we're a long way away from anything that I would be trumpeting, you know, in Washington or elsewhere.
If 70% of the economy, 70% or so of the economy is based on consumer spending, and yet we have this trend, this deep trend towards temporary and low-paying jobs, what does that portend for the future economy?
Well, it's kind of amazing what kind of amnesia we continue to experience in this country, right? 2008, we have the worst economic meltdown in our lives. Everybody says, oh, you know, everything has changed. We're never going back to the way things were. And then, you know, a year and a half later, here we are back on the treadmill. I think that the only way growth is going to restart, if you look at what both the economic policy kingpins in Washington are advising and what actually is happening out there in the world, is getting back on that debt treadmill. I mean, they're basically trying to gin back up the same kind of economy that we experienced in the Clinton years, that we experienced in the Bush years, which is essentially substituting good wages for, you know, substituting debt for good wages. And what that's going to leave us with is another, as you know, another unsustainable situation that's going to lead to another collapse if we can even get things going. Because it's not clear that they're going to be able to crank up the debt machine again.
Are there any looming bubble possibilities? That is, how can one create another bubble? You can't do it with housing. You can't do it with credit cards. What is the potential bubble?
Well, I think that's what they're scrambling in Washington to figure out. I mean, I think that they're a little bit out of options, and that's why we're going to be in for a really long, ugly period here in the country, economically speaking. I mean, you know, let's just step back and remember, despite all the clapping and cheering in D.C. about the jobs numbers, we're still 11 million jobs short of where we were before the recession hit. We got 25 million people who can't find a job, can't find full-time work, who've given up looking altogether. And at this rate, it'd take us till 2018 to get back to where we were before the recession. So I don't see any clear signs of growth. I don't see anything that makes me confident that we're going to get people back to work in any significant number. And I actually don't see on their own terms how they're going to get a bubble started again, because it certainly isn't going to come from the housing market, as you say, when, you know, one out of every five homeowners is underwater in their mortgage. It's not going to come from, you know, the stock market again. That seems clear. So, you know, it's a real quandary for the Obama administration, for policymakers in Washington, because, frankly, the only answer is to actually put more money in the hands of working people's pockets. And to do that means to redistribute from the rich to the rest of us. And they seem completely allergic to that formula.
And Obama seems to have written off the possibilities of stimulus.
Wow, yeah, it's amazing the conversion that's happened to that man and his administration. They've gone from a candidate who's talking about things like investment in green jobs and, you know, a brand new infrastructure for the country to somebody who is the high priest of austerity. It's really unbelievable. But it's not surprising, because if you look at who Obama surrounded himself with, if you look at who really runs Washington, it's not us, it's Goldman Sachs and other folks on Wall Street and in the financial sector. They're the ones calling the shots, and frankly, there's no interest on their parts in the kind of economic vision that Obama, the candidate, was hinting at, and certainly that the rest of us require to put this country on a sounder, you know, financial and economic footing.
Once Obama agreed with Wall Street and the Republicans that the deficit was the biggest problem facing the country, I suppose all the rest of his actions flow.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable, this deficit question. I mean, I know that ordinary, you know, regular people are not so, sane people are not so focused on it. But boy, I am obsessed with this debate, because it's just, it's Alice in Wonderland. Here we are in a situation where people want to make the debt into the biggest national emergency since 9/11. And frankly, I mean, they're not willing to talk about the drivers of the debt. I mean, look, why are we in debt? We're in debt for four main reasons. Number one, the two wars and the two undeclared wars, the two declared wars and the two undeclared wars that we've got going on right now. Two, the healthcare crisis and the fact that medical costs are going up in double digits. So solution number one is stop these foreign adventures. Solution number two is actually healthcare reform that controls costs, which is ultimately a single payer system like the rest of the industrialized world. Point number three that's driving this is the recession, this incredible economic collapse. And the only way to get that fixed is to put people back to work. And, you know, they were absolutely unwilling to discuss any of these problems in the context of the debt crisis and the sort of debate around debt. The only real solutions they have are belt tightening and austerity for most working people. It's really, really unbelievable. And it's actually an absolute disaster for working folks. If we follow the Ryan plan, if you follow the Obama plan, none of it spells good news for the rest of us.
And of course, that undermines the economy as a whole. It seems that the capitalists are opposed to saving capitalism.
You do have to wonder sometimes if folks are thinking about the system as a whole in Washington anymore. I mean, you know, I remember reading stuff from the 1960s and 1970s where the leading industrialists and the bankers, they did think about it as a system, and they did worry about the system's health. And even if it meant you know, restraining some of what would actually be good for them individually, they were willing to do what they needed to preserve the entire economy under, you know, the most favorable terms, as you put it, you know, bluntly, to save capitalism. And they don't seem, you know, with some possible exceptions like Warren Buffett and a few other people, there really doesn't seem to be a layer of folks at the top of the financial food chain who are thinking in those terms. And I think that's really a dangerous place for this country.
Standard & Poor's raised the question of whether it would continue to give the United States government its highest ratings. Could it be that the markets, which really are just a bunch of rich people, are going to launch an assault on the U.S. state like they have in Europe?
Oh, I don't think so. I think this is just a way of backing up the Obama and Ryan warnings to the American people that the debt is serious, that we need to do it now. It's a way of scaring the average Americans and giving you know, more excuses for Fox News and others to rattle their sabers about the looming debt crisis and deficit problems that the country's facing. I mean, look, you know, who are these folks, these rating agencies? I mean, these are the same people that were telling us that these collateralized debt obligations and these fancy, you know, mortgage-backed securities that Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and all these other financial firms were trading as AAA, you know, rated, were actually complete toxic junk. You know, so, I mean, you know, this is a situation of the fox guarding the hen house here. And clearly, it is designed and executed solely for the purpose of putting fear in average Americans' hearts that we've got to do something about this, and for making the case for austerity.
You're saying that the ratings agencies are trying to politically intimidate the public.
Absolutely. I mean, this wouldn't be the first time that we've seen Wall Street essentially declare a doomsday scenario and try to actually make their prophecies self-fulfilling. I mean, I think that, you know, remember the debate around the bailout. Hank Paulson comes up to Congress and basically says, I need you to give me billions and billions, hundreds of billions, close to $2 trillion if you actually count everything that they asked for, and absolutely give me carte blanche on how to oversee it and administer it. And if you don't do that, what we're going to have is complete global meltdown. You know, these folks were essentially playing chicken with our political leaders. And although, you know, in the end, they still got a tremendous deal because, come on, they got almost, you know, they got bailed out on the insurance side of it with AIG. They got bailed out on the bank side of it with all the cash infusions. And in the end of the day, the only people who were paying, you know, at all is us, right? I mean, how many people are behind bars after this knowing fraud that was, you know, conducted on Wall Street? Nobody, right? I mean, there's not a single person in jail behind this. So it's clear to me that the this is all, you know, part and parcel of an effort to get the austerity engine revved up and running. And I think that, you know, it's definitely working, at least if you read the headlines, right? This is the only conversation in town.
If theoretically or hypothetically the 11 million jobs could return by 2018, what kind of job scene would it be in terms of not just salaries, but job security?
Well, Glenn, I mean, this is the real crisis in our economy. The fact is that, you know, as you know, and as many of your listeners probably know, the war on workers has been going on for a lot longer than the last year. I mean, the attacks on the public sector, on defined benefit pensions, on job security, and on unions, hasn't, you know, it's not something that just started with the economic meltdown. I mean, this is something that's been going on in the private sector since at least Reagan's first term, if not really before that. And so we've seen the squeeze on good jobs for almost three decades. And now what we're really discovering is that they're actually people in this country that really are determined to make sure that there's really only, you know, two classes, right? There's the folks that are just scraping by, that are not even making a living wage, no benefits, you know, no health care, essentially really living on the edge. And then there's the folks at the very, very top. I mean, that's essentially what they're trying to do. They're trying to destroy any job that would actually give you some modicum of security, some modicum of stability, and turn everything into like a Walmart type job. And they're succeeding. I mean, if you look at what's happening in manufacturing, I mean, just look at the UAW. You've taken what was the sort of leading edge of working class jobs in this country, and now you've driven it down to non-union standards, even where the union is present. New hires in a UAW plant are making roughly, you know, $16, $17 an hour, which is what non-union manufacturing workers make in the Midwest. So, you know, I'm not saying that's the lowest end of the job market. Clearly, you know, minimum wage is much lower. But, you know, going from a situation of $27 an hour with full benefits and a pension and 4 weeks of paid vacation to $14 to $17 an hour with a 401k and much slimmer health care benefits is a pretty steep fall. And I think that as long as they keep pushing us down, there's really, you know, it's hard to see the bottom in this. But, I mean, as we know in Wisconsin and other places, what the good news is, of course, that people are fighting back. People recognize that, you know, you can't just ask for it. You've got to fight for it. Because there seems to be no limit to what these folks are willing to try to take from us.
Mark Brenner is editor of Labor Notes.
Jared Ball is an editor and columnist of Black Agenda Report and teaches communications at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Dr. Ball was at the recent Media Reform Conference in Boston, where he discussed the state of hip-hop politics.
There are four things I just wanted to say off the top. Well, a fifth thing now, because I wanted to, again, publicly identify myself with this hip-hop radical label, and I think it's essential that we expose as many of the arguments and contradictions that exist in hip-hop as a cultural expression, in the scholarship, in the journalism that emanates out of it or that is used to cover it, because ultimately, which is the first point I just wanted to make, we are in a political struggle, and I think that that is ultimately what always has to be remembered. It's a media reform movement. There are other efforts within this society and around the world to change the world, but those are all subsets of a broader political struggle. However you want to identify that or define that, that's another discussion or debate, but I think that's the first thing we have to always remember. And I'll come back to that in just a second. But the second point I just want to make is that media are ideological. We are not talking about the organized technologies of media. We need to understand them as ideological and in service of a political struggle. And thirdly, we need an underground press. George Jackson, I want to evoke his name as often as possible, the great philosopher, political scientist, political prisoner, said that we need three things. We need an underground army. I'm not a revolutionary, so I'm not going to do that. But we also need an underground press, and we need a radical alternative political party if we're going to advocate and promote and make popular the ideas that we need change and real change in this society, in this world. And then fourth, we need a social movement to do that. We need the movement that is meant to emanate out of that. And I don't want us to think that the media reform movement or any of the other things that many of us are involved in constitute this movement in any way that I think needs to be seen as sufficient. So I just want to go back to those points just very quickly and reiterate just a few and give some depth to some of them. This idea of a political struggle. Now, my preference is to use the internal colonialism theory or analysis or perspective when talking about Black America and Latin America. I don't like this idea that we're talking about, America as a failed democracy or America as, you know, being somehow, you know, just slightly deficient here or there. No, America is an empire, and a lot of people here talk about America as an empire. Many of the books that are written at this conference and are on sale at this conference describe America as an empire. But then it seems the analysis that flows from that initial point seems to dissipate or just simply disappear. If America is indeed an empire, then we have to acknowledge that empires don't create democracies and free citizens. They create colonies, including those nations subsumed within the very borders of the United States. Of course, the indigenous population, Black America, Latin America, Chicano populations have long been theorized like this is nothing new that I'm doing. It's just that this wing of analysis has been suppressed just like many other things are suppressed in this society as an empire is supposed to do. It's supposed to suppress that which would develop its own demise. So we get a lot of analyses that emanate from this idea that we have a flawed democracy, and with some tweaks here or there, will be okay. And I think that results in a lot of stagnant and short-run, incomplete movements. Secondly, as I said, media are ideological. Once you understand, by the way, let me just back up. Frantz Fanon said just very simply, colonialism is the complete and total conquering of land and people. Period. That's all. In fact, he said that is all. So it's not that deep. It's that we're talking about conquering land and people. So in that sense, we can't be talking about people just, you know, not having, again, perfect forms of democracy to reach to, where the vote isn't somehow just, you know, whatever. We just need to, you know, do more to influence our politicians and so on and so forth. That isn't how you end a colonial relationship. Unfortunately, it would be nice if it were that simple. So as part of a political struggle, once we establish that, then we can talk about media as ideological. Again, media are often described as the technologies. We talk about media in terms of film, radio, so on and so forth, instead of the ideas that they're used to disseminate, the ranges of thought they're supposed to establish as sanctioned and acceptable. So if as Rosa demonstrated, if you challenge Nancy Pelosi at a media reform conference, you'll get mild support at best, because that hasn't been established as an acceptable norm, an acceptable. And this is, of course, what popular hip-hop, popular scholarship, popular news, popular, you know, films are designed to do, give an acceptable range of thought. And if you go outside of that range, you are deemed as inappropriate at best. And at worst, you're put in prison, like many of the political prisoners who are still left in there. So with all due respect to Brother Manning, all these political prisoners have been in worse conditions or similar conditions for many more years. You're talking about people who are in prison in solitary confinement for decades. who are not even discussed, even in media reform spaces. They're not even discussed. We don't interview them. We don't tell stories about them. They're not sexy. Nobody wants to, you know, nobody cares, because not only because of the struggle they represented, but the hopelessness that's often associated with their cases. So we just ignore it. And you're right, and Rose is right, that they're also assassinated as well if they're not, you know, fortunate enough to be put in a cage for the rest of their lives. But this is what media are supposed to do. So I think we sometimes lose sight of that in discussions, especially in these spaces of media reform. We lose sight of what media are here to do. So it's not a matter of reforming media. Media as they currently exist have to be completely abolished. And that, of course, can only happen if you have a political movement that replaces the hierarchy, that replaces those in power with new forms of power, new forms of dominant ideas. By the way, there's if any of you ever take the time, the International Journal of Communication ran a really great debate, actually, that took place between which included Robert McChesney and three others who were very critical of this media reform movement. And Makani Themba Nixon was one of the contributors, and she raises the point. I just want to just say this very quickly, because the argument is that brought up to criticize this media reform movement was that it does disassociate itself from the more oppressed communities in this society. It doesn't talk about the other political issues affecting more oppressed communities, and they felt that there was this disconnect weakening this media reform movement. And Makani Themba Nixon simply, you know, I'm not trying to reduce her entire argument, but she does say that media reform has struggled with nearly all of the typical challenges in this regard. And what she means by typical challenges is something that Rosa brought up very quickly also, that there is always this tension between radicalism and reform, or revolutionary politics and reform politics, and also this tension that exists, unfortunately, between white liberals and black and brown radicals, where, you know, a little bit of room is afforded, a little bit of space is afforded, and, you know, even go so far as to vote for a black president, but real issues affecting these communities and really engaging in the arguments that radicals or so-called radicals or revolutionaries bring up conceptually are ignored or suppressed. So even when, you know, and I've even done some degree of study of this, even when we look at Democracy Now! And Robert McChesney's Media Matters radio program and others, including Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Counterspin and others, you see a complete absence of stories focused on black and brown people, and indigenous people even worse. So when there was a study that came out a couple last year that was where a lot of the left-leaning media were focused on, where NBC's Meet the Press, as the flagship Sunday morning news program, was analyzed and said that black people are absent, I think, at 77% of those shows have no black people on there. Well, I went through the calendar year and looked at Democracy Now!, and in terms of black Americans who were on the program to discuss black American-centered issues, it was even less than that. 88%, I think, was the percentage I reached, had no black discussion at all. And I think we could do the same thing for Latin America, and I think indigenous people is even more easier. I mean, I think they did two shows with indigenous focus in the calendar year. So if Democracy Now! Was the flagship of the media reform world, we see the same kind of erasure of black focus, of Native American focus, of Latino focus. And within that, the radical wing of these communities' politics would even be less represented. So this is something that we've argued in terms of hip-hop as well. You know, you're going to get a lot of popular reference to rap music, but even in left-leaning spaces, progressive or radical rap music is equally ignored. It is the hardest thing to get access to in terms of media exposure, even on the left-leaning, in left-leaning outlets, which is, again, the cultural equivalent to the political, that political radical politics or radical political politics are excluded by the nature of the system and those who defend it to whatever degree that they do. So again, this is why I'm arguing we need an underground press. I've argued that the mixtape, as hip-hop's original mass medium, could be put to this use. We've tried a project in the D.C. area where I am. It has not been successful, and I'm the first one to admit it for a number of different reasons. Number one, I've become more disconnected from a grassroots political organization, which is a problem for me individually and all of us collectively. But it is also a low-tech, inexpensive option that allows for a free run of cultural and political and journalistic content that can't get anywhere else on radio, including in many cases low-power FM, which is another thing we could discuss as well. And then again, just to go back to the fifth point with George Jackson, what he ultimately was concluding is that we need a movement. We just need a movement. We don't have it. It doesn't exist at this point. And it's the negative impact of that is manifesting daily by the second all over the country and around the world. And very lastly, I just want to say, as I give up the mic, Amiri Baraka, our great elder, and I mean that, he came on the radio, on my radio program in 2008, and beat me and Rosa up for 2 hours, telling us that we were fools, scoundrels, rascals for supporting Cynthia McKinney and not supporting Barack Obama. I do hope you all saw his most recent poem, The New Invasion of Africa, where he says that now you have a black president working for the colonial powers of the Western world, invading Africa, and he says, returning us to slavery. I hope we all think about that in terms of where we are on the left and even on the radical left as we raise critiques of those who would raise challenges to Obama, as we're going to do again in 2012, and think seriously about what we're going to do politically in this society if we're going to overcome any of the serious problems that continue to face us, if we can't even have the discussion about Obama in these spaces or elsewhere, or what Obama or the cultural equivalent of Obama in terms of rap music and other forms of cultural expression.
Black Agenda editor and columnist Dr. Jared Ball.
Local 10 of the International Longshore and Warehousers Union is being sued by West Coast port owners for refusing to handle cargo on April 4th, the date of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. Clarence Thomas is a former secretary treasurer of the local and a co-founder of the Million Workers March movement. He says the longshore workers have a long history of taking labor action for political purposes.
There are various defense committees that have been developed for the purpose of defending the ILWU Local 10. We've been getting tremendous feedback from workers all over the country as well as all over the world. Remember, Local 10 is the union that refused to handle South African cargo for 11 days in 1984. It is the union that during the 1970s refused to handle boycotted ships to bloody military dictatorships in Chile and El Salvador. This is the union that in 1999 shut down all 29 ports in support of the release of Mumia Abu-Jamal on the 1st of May, in 2008. We shut down all 29 ports on the West Coast to oppose the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. On June 20th of last year, we refused to cross a picket line that had been placed where an Israeli vessel was about to berth in protest to the Israeli commandos killing 9 civilians who were attempting to provide humanitarian supplies to Gaza. And just this past October 23rd, we shut down 5 ports in the Bay Area in solidarity with Oscar Grant family. And the Justice for Oscar Grant, Jail to Kill a Cop. So our reputation as a rank-and-file, bottom-up, militant democratic union who has a history of fighting for the working class on questions of economic and social justice is well documented. Essentially, what has happened is that on April the 4th, which was the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the AFL-CIO adopted a resolution calling for no business as usual on that date in response to the attacks upon labor, specifically from Republican governors in some 16 states, Wisconsin being in the forefront. The attacks are specifically the dismantling of collective bargaining. In other states, like Ohio, they want to circumvent unions being able to have dues checkoff. That is when dues money is automatically deducted from one's payroll check. They also want to do such things as prohibit unions from being able to contribute to political campaigns. And but what one needs to understand is that this is not simply an attack on public sector workers. It is also an attack on public services, and specifically the way that that is being waged, that struggle is being waged against workers, is with budget cuts. The crisis of capitalism, which has been spearheaded by the various forms of conspiracies against the working class, transferring public wealth into private hands, led by Wall Street, has resulted in Republicans in particular wanting to balance these budget deficits on the back of the working class. This at the same time is happening. The Republicans are granting large tax cuts to the rich and to corporations. So the action of ILW Local 10 resulted in our members individually deciding that they would not go to work on April the 4th, that this was a voluntary rank and file action that resulted in a successful organized resistance action. For 24 hours, there were no vessels work in the port of Oakland and the port of San Francisco. Now, one of the things that is important to remember is that in Wisconsin, the South Central Labor Federation decided that it would vote to have to consider taking action in the way of a general strike if Governor Scott Walker were to invoke the law prohibiting collective bargaining. Now, what happened was that the Democratic Party, in response to that, and also the labor tops, decided that that wasn't the way to go, that they wanted to see labor spend its time recalling candidates in Wisconsin, Republicans, that is, who were voting to invoke this law that would prohibit collective bargaining. And they discouraged any kind of display of rank-and-file action at the workplace because this is not where they want to see labor's voices heard. They would much rather have labor being subservient to the Democratic Party and doing their bidding by recalling candidates, doing voter registration, and the like. So that poses the question, is the Democratic Party's objectives and goals the same as that of labor? And I would submit to you that they are not the same. There was only the action taken by ILW Local 10, where workers actually withheld their labor or took any significant action at the point of production. We believe that this is the only way in which labor is going to be able to stop these attacks. These attacks are orchestrated, they're deliberate, and the goal is to put labor in the same position that it was before the signing of the New Deal. It's specifically what I'm talking about, before there was a National Labor Relations Act, before there was a right for workers to have unions. That is the goal of the corporate agenda, as well as the right-wing Republican agenda. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party is being complicit in this agenda because the labor movement supported the Democratic Party in the last election, and one of the things that it had told the Democrats that it wanted to address as soon as possible was to have an Employee Free Choice Act, which would give workers an opportunity to have unfettered right to organize unions without any retaliation on the part of employers. That was not enacted by the Democratic Party. What we did see were tax cuts for the rich, bailouts. We saw a health proposal put in place, otherwise known as Obamacare, without any kind of a public benefit, specifically the ability to have Medicare for all. Essentially, we need universal health care. And so the public option, as it was described by the Obama administration, was completely taken off the table. So when we look at these actions on the part of the Democratic Party, then we can see that labor needs to chart its own course. Labor needs to have its own agenda, just like the corporations have their own agenda. Workers need to have theirs. And the action taken by ILWU Local 10 speaks to the whole question of the rank and file. Those are the individuals who are the membership of all unions. I'm not talking about the officers. I'm talking about the people who pay dues, needs to exercise its rank and file unity and take those actions at the point of production, which is going to be able to create some kind of disruption of business as usual with respect to these employers, so that we can then begin to exercise the leverage that we need as workers in this country to make the pendulum swing the other way.
If you're going to mount that kind of fight back by the rank and file, it appears you're going to have to fight your way through a lot of union leadership as well as the Democratic Party.
Well, this is exactly why we launched the Million Worker March movement in 2004. On October 17, 2004, roughly 10 to 15,000 trade unionists, unorganized workers, social justice activists, anti-war activists as well, we assembled at the Lincoln Memorial. And we put forward a workers' agenda, and it included such things as ending the war in Iraq, protecting Social Security, the establishment of universal health care, stop the dismantling of public education, cutting the military budget, and many other demands. What we found out was that the labor tops, specifically the AFL-CIO, they sent out notices to all of its affiliates, directing them not to devote any time or money to that organizing effort, notwithstanding the fact that everything that was being put forward benefited the working class, but that all of their emphasis was going to be placed on the election of John Kerry. And so this was something that was a part of the Democratic Party's agenda, so you're absolutely right. Workers need to mobilize and organize in their own name, independent of the two corporate parties. And so this is essential. And so one of the things that has happened is that there has been a reluctance on the part of labor to actually criticize President Obama. And in so doing, it has opened up the political space for the Tea Party to emerge. And it's important to mention that many of the elements of the Tea Party, in terms of its functionaries and rank and file, come from the working class. It is just that their philosophy is, in my opinion, is misguided. It is also racist. But it is a formulation of an ideology that emanates from frustration with respect to the current economic crisis, but the major contradiction is that it supports the ruling class in corporate America. If labor had been much more pronounced and forceful in putting forward its own agenda, I believe that this would have mitigated the possibility for the appeal of the Tea Party to many within the working class. So what needs to happen right now, if labor is to survive, they're going to have to organize and mobilize in their own name.
Labor activist Clarence Thomas, speaking from Oakland, California.
While the United States is busy destabilizing other countries around the planet, its own huge national security budget may be destabilizing the United States. Bruce Fine, author of the book America's Empire Before the Fall, says war spending is bringing the empire down.
$1.2 trillion all pivoting on this wrong-headed, unconstitutional idea that as an empire we have some kind of obligation, mission, crusade to make the world safe for what we conceive as enlightened government. And so we have thousands of military bases. We got wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, got a semi-war in Libya. We pronounced that we may go anywhere in the world for so-called humanitarian purposes. And humanitarian war is a euphemism. That's a contradiction in terms. It's what poets call an oxymoron. Now, the idea of war is it makes what's customarily murder legal. And with all of this projection of military power all around the globe, we run these exaggerated deficits of $1.5 trillion, $14.5 trillion national debt that's ruining us financially. And neither the Republicans nor the Democrats will take the jugular and say, no, we've got to renounce empire. Otherwise, we will fall away as all previous empires into ruination from overreach and overspending.
Why is the war budget immune to debate?
Because it is an earmark of empire. I call it in my recent book, The American Empire Before the Fall, that it's the psychology of empire, it infects the entire culture, the entire discourse. And the entire country is grown up on this idea, inculcated from day one, that the United States needs to be everywhere in the world. If we see anything that we think is untoward towards women or minorities or religious sex or whatever, then we have to begin a war to try to cure it. This is a psychology that infects all empires. It gives what the British called a psychological thrill. Hey, we're the bully on the playground. We get to do what we want. And that is why no one has the courage, the leadership to say this is wrong. We don't want to be an empire. We're a republic, just like we don't want to be colonized. We don't want to be a colonizer. As Lincoln said, he didn't want to be a slave. He didn't want to be a master either. And until someone has the courage to say, you may say I'm weak, that I don't want to bring the American greatness to all the heavens, interplanetary, intergalactic, but that's what the founding fathers knew would happen to the United States if we changed from a republic to an empire. We would lose all of our liberty and reason for existence.
I remember in the months after the Iraq invasion, when it was commonly thought that the United States had won a war, that the corporate media seemed quite at ease in wondering if the United States was a new Rome. They liked the idea.
Well, that's exactly right, because I say some people, I view it as a very adolescent gratification, but that's what the culture is gratifying. Hey, we're number one. We're number one. It's a football game. You know, the world international relations is a football game, or American Idol, and you try to get to be number one. And then you think, hey, how I am, you swagger, and you think, oh, we're superior to other people. I mean, it's part of this adolescent, juvenile idea of American exceptionalism, like somehow Americans are born with different genes. You know, we don't have the same vices as other human beings who are born in different geographic areas or different climates. And that is why this continuing idea of in the media and elsewhere that either tacitly or urges us on to this empire status persists. No one will stand up and say, no, we don't want to be the ruler of the world. We don't want swagger. We want our influence to be the influence of example simpliciter, not any further than that. The influence of example otherwise. No, we take care of the United States. We have a lot of warts and things to cure at home, make it a more perfect union. But no, we are not have the arrogance, the kind of teenage boast to go abroad and tell other people how they ought to live their lives.
You speak of the United States acting like Mighty Mouse, there to save the day and righting wrongs. But the United States doesn't make war against Saudi Arabia, where women are oppressed.
Well, it may. It may if it thinks the Saudi Arabian king is in jeopardy. Just like, who knows? I mean, we didn't make war in Libya until a little while ago. So we don't know. But you're right in the sense that we pick and choose where we decide we're going to be Don Quixote and the White Knight or whatever. It's not anything that's even-handedly applied because it shows the corruption of our own moral posturing. I mean, if it really were true that the humanitarian concerns were what drive us everywhere, I mean, Libya is about number 80 on the list. Then we would have been invaded long ago, as you say. In Saudi Arabia, where it's perhaps the most religiously bigoted Wahhabi nation in the world, we'd be in Tibet, we'd be in Chechnya, we'd be in North Korea, we'd be in Zimbabwe, and there's an endless number of countries. It was really humanitarianism. But it isn't. It's just we're doing what we feel like doing because it happens to be politically convenient at the time. Now, that's what it amounts to, and it shows the moral corruption of the justification.
In material terms, not rhetorical terms, what is the difference between the Obama administration's war and spending policies and its predecessor, the Bush administration?
Well, in the defense area, there's virtually none. I mean, the projection is all the same of the power. I mean, if anything, Obama's even escalated the troop presence in Afghanistan. We are now, you're already seeing, we are spending $350 million a day in Afghanistan. Now, that's more than even when Bush was spending. And so this is a seamless transition, if you will, from what I call the Bush-Cheney diumvirate into the, now we have the Bush-Cheney-Obama triumvirate. Because the themes, the spending, the goals, the objectives are indistinguishable from one another.
What about what we used to think of as the anti-war faction, at least, among Democrats in Congress? How effective or ineffective have they been?
Well, they're about as prominent, I suppose, as unicorns. It's a diminishing number. We have Dennis Kucinich a handful of others, but it's basically, they look like museum pieces back in the Vietnam War era. And there really isn't, either on either side of the aisle, either the Tea Party people who you would think would not be in favor of empire if they want small government, or the liberal side that really has numbers. It's not to say that there aren't there. There are a few courageous people out there. Barbara Lee, Dennis Kucinich, Walter Jones on the Republican side, Ron Paul. But we're dealing with Congress now, 100 senators, 435 members of the House. And when you have your peace crowd is about a dozen, that isn't going to carry much weight.
And what about the state of the anti-war movement, or is there such a thing anymore?
Well, I don't really think that there's it's not worthy of the name to call it a movement because the numbers are too small. You know, it's like calling, William Lloyd Garrison the first person in the North with great courage standing up and say the end of slavery at the covenant with hell in 1831. You know, was there an anti-slavery movement at the time? I mean, it was too small to call it a movement. And even though, before Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, was there really a civil rights movement when a few, blacks stood up and said the oppression has ended? It doesn't have the numbers. It's not that the individuals still aren't very, very celebrated and courageous and admirable people, but it's not enough. Democracies move by numbers, and right now it's too small to be called a movement.
I believe that your central thesis is that this empire will succumb to overreach. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, and we're seeing it right now. We are borrowing as a country about $4 billion every single day, $4 billion every day. And as soon as the interest rates start to climb because of the increased risk of buying those treasuries, that's not going to be 4, that's going to be 8, and then it's going to be 12. It's not sustainable, and ultimately it will bring us to ruination. We will have a financial collapse, the overreach. Is causing virtually every country in the world to build up resentment against the United States because of our swagger and arrogance and condescension towards everybody and anything else that doesn't emulate us. And it's just a matter of time. Now, sometimes empires last for 80 years, 90 years. The Roman Empire lasted for centuries. We may hobble on and muddle through before we collapse for another 50 years or 80 years or so. It's hard to know. You don't know who our rival is going to be, but the destination is quite clear unless, I say, a leader stands up and says, no, we will not. We are dismantling our empire unilaterally. We want to be a republic. We're limiting our influence abroad to the influence of example. We're slashing that $1.2 trillion budget to $100 billion, saving $1.1 trillion, and we will devote ourselves to making the United States a more perfect union, and we will limit defense to actually defending the United States against attack rather than in what former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has called anticipatory self-defense, anticipating someone might attack us in the next 100 years, and we start wars for that reason.
Author Bruce Fine.
President Obama was regaled with song at a recent campaign fundraiser in San Francisco, but Barr senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says it wasn't the kind of tune the president liked.
A group of people at a fundraiser in California interrupted the proceedings singing a song about Bradley Manning and said, "We paid our dues and where's our change," was one of the lines that they asked. I suppose it was significant that somebody publicly asked Obama about Bradley Manning. What was more significant is what he said after when he was asked about it. There is, thank God for YouTube, there is some bad footage of it, but you can tell what he's saying. Basically, he said that Manning was guilty. That's the most important thing that he said about someone who has not been tried. We've not seen evidence against Bradley Manning. He has not been in court, so I don't know how the president, who, and everybody loves to talk about the fact that he was a law professor, he should know better than to say someone's guilty who has never been in a courtroom.
Yes, I would think that might be grounds for dismissal when the person with the biggest bully pulpit in the land says you're guilty.
Yes, it should be, but of course Manning will be tried in a military court. Not frankly that it would help him much, actually, if he were tried in a civilian court at this point. You know, the prosecutors generally do get their person. And when the President of the United States is the prosecutor, it's highly unlikely that there can be a not guilty verdict. One of the things I wanted to point out about Manning is it's clear that it's disgraceful the way he's been treated, being kept naked in his cell, being kept in solitary confinement. In addition, a UN rapporteur on torture named Juan Mendez has asked to see Bradley Manning and has been prevented from seeing him without their conversation being observed. And that's the sort of thing that the United States criticizes other countries for. We, you know, talk about third world despots and dictatorships and so forth. But we have the United States, which is supposed to be better than those countries doing the same thing. Others have been prevented from seeing Bradley Manning, including Congressman Dennis Kucinich, either prevented outright or told that they cannot speak to him in private.
But this president said he doesn't engage in torture. Most people would consider that the psychological treatment that Bradley Manning and others have mm-hmm. been subjected to is a form of torture.
Oh, well, it is to anybody. I mean, if it were anybody other than Bradley Manning, I'm sure Barack Obama would have said, I suppose before he was president, would have agreed that absolutely is torture, but now that he's president, he does what presidents do. And the Bush administration gave up any pretense of following the rules of international law, of common decency, of the Constitution, and the Obama administration has followed suit.
Bradley Manning seems to be a relatively harmless-looking, likable young man. Why would the administration risk making him into a martyr?
It's to teach other people a lesson. Basically, don't mess with us. Don't even think about revealing that the United States is committing war crimes. And that's the essence of if the materials that Manning is accused of releasing, among them the video showing U.S. troops murdering Iraqi civilians, including a journalist, as proof of war crimes. And if it becomes, and this was revealed through WikiLeaks, if that information of that type is released again, it just proves that the United States is a nation run by war criminals. And the point of torturing Bradley Manning is to teach everybody a lesson and not to think, not to even consider for a moment that they would, A, get away with doing such a thing, and to make the point that you will be broken if you're even accused of such a thing. So it's a way of keeping other people quiet.
I remember the dirty bomber, the mm-hmm. young Puerto Rican man who was accused of trying to build a dirty bomb, and he was subjected to all kinds of unspeakable treatment by the U.S. military.
Yes, Padilla.
In Padilla. And in the end, of course, the charges regarding the dirty bomb were dropped. Apparently, there never was one.
Oh, exactly. After being held not only in solitary confinement, after I remember seeing this horrific photo of Padilla. They had to take him for a medical appointment, and they literally covered his eyes. He had to wear these bizarre goggles so that he couldn't see anything. And they literally drove him crazy. And in the end, what they charged him with was a far more minor crime. Of course, he was convicted also. But they got away with it. The Bush administration got away with it. And the Obama administration, of course, seeing that the Bush administration can get away with it, is not of a mind to do anything differently. And, you know, the imperatives of people in power don't change. Even if one has an R behind his name and one has a D behind his name, it ends up being the same thing. So there will be more Padillas and more Bradley Mannings in our future.
That was Margaret Kimberly speaking from New York.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.